On Rules and Public Affairs, today, June 17, 2003. Colleagues, we're going to be having the public hearing first of House Bill 3640. We'll then move to a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3154. And then we'll end our day with the pleasantries of the proposed amendment to House Rule 2.05. So with that, let's open up a public hearing on 3640. And we'll ask Julie Brandis and Commissioner Beyer come forward. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Members of the House Rules Committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. For the past 7 years, I've handled energy issues for Associated Oregon Industries. And one of the things that stands out very clearly in my mind over the past 7 years is that this is an incredibly dynamic industry. It is really changing all the time. And last week, with the announcement of Roy Hemingway's retirement, the ever-changing environment seemed to continue. Although our concerns with the commission were process-related as opposed to personality-related, we view this change as an opportunity to take a clean slate with the new commissioners and open a broader process to review the elements of House Bill 3575 and House Bill 3640, the bill before you today. Many of these elements can be addressed in rules. Let me be clear, we do not want a long and drawn-out rules process at the PUC, and if you ever want an interesting social studies experience, I ask you to spend a little bit of time over at the commission because it is a very completely different process than the legislative process. But again, we don't want a long, drawn-out process because that would be expensive for all the parties. We would, however, accept an opportunity to address priority concerns and the need to create a more balanced process at the PUC. During the last months, AOI has been told numerous times, the commission can do all of this in rules. And AOI has often retorted, well, why haven't they? Customer groups have been very loud and very upset with the commission since October 2001. Still, a new commission does set new opportunities for the customers and the utilities. As most of you know, AOI has been very assertive and aggressive in providing the governor with recommendations for the PUC process. By doing so, we have relayed to the governor, the legislature, and to the commission that AOI will not sit idly by and watch the commission make the decisions that stall our economy without a fight and without seeking changes in a process that is expensive to participate in, and it's so expensive that groups such as AOI and the Hospital Association and the Metals Council really can't afford to play in. With that, our board did take a position last Friday on staff recommendation to let the new commission get to work and to allow these new leaders to review our concerns and develop a process to make changes either in rule or in statute next session. The one issue that may not be able to be addressed in rules is related to rate mitigation. You'll hear today that the language we proposed is unconstitutional. We all may also hear from Commissioner Beyer that they already have the authority to mitigate rates. As you know, in October of 2001, an enormous rate hike hit many AOI members. This is not old news. It lives in every member we visit within that utility territory. We've had two members' visits in the last 10 days. These companies have told us they will not expand their operations, they will not expand employment because of the energy costs. But it's not just about the prices. It's about how the prices can't be predicted, and they can't foresee what's going to happen within the next 6 months to their energy prices. We begged the commission last October 2001 to find a way to mitigate the rate case. The best option they presented to us was that the utility did voluntarily agree to mitigate the rate case, but only if the customers could agree to a carrying charge. And I think that carrying charge was around 9%. Our members did back away from that proposal. In light of the changes proposed last week, Commissioner Hemingway retiring, we will even back away from the mitigation proposal before you today. Although many of the coalition members I have worked with on this issue think we should continue to push for mitigation. Last night, I was asked a question by a coalition member. What if there's another 50% rate increase? What is going to happen then? What if the new commissioners choose to do nothing to protect customers? I don't know the answer to that. There are rate cases pending. As I stated earlier, the energy world changes and changes and changes, so I believe a large increase could easily happen again. Mr. Chair, you and Representative Close and your respective committee members have done an outstanding job on airing these issues this session, and AOI appreciates that. Just because there's a PUC commission doesn't mean that the legislature should remove itself from energy policy. The legislature should play a role, and we thank you for attention to these matters. I've also met with the majority of the committees and most of the House and Senate members on these issues, and most seem to understand the level of concern the business community has with both rates and the process. AOI members took a position over a year ago to address rate notification and rate mitigation. Last Friday, as I stated, upon staff recommendation, the board was willing to take a breather, only because of the degree of which the commission is changing. Commissioner Beyer perhaps can answer those questions stated last night. What will happen if there's another 50% rate increase? And he can also comment on what tools the commission currently has to mitigate, and his willingness and his commitment to AOI to look at the process to provide greater fairness for the customers.
Thank you. Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Lee Beyer, Commissioner with the Oregon Public Utility Commission. One of the few remaining workers, apparently. We've had a lot of chance to discuss this in my not quite 2 years with the commission, the different areas, and I think we have addressed a lot of the issues and people have gotten more comfortable. My personal commitment that I've expressed to Julie and to others is that what's most important to me is that those who participated in our process and eventually the consumers maybe don't always like the answer in the end, but they should feel that the process was fair and that the commission was acting to the best of its ability in consumers' interest. And I think that's something we have to take up, and I'm committed to taking up again as we get into the fall. I only say in the fall because you have a little bit of our attention right now, and we'd like to see the work that you complete so we can fold that in. Meet with groups in a more of an informal process and see if we can resolve some of these. How that will go, I don't know. We have certainly the authority to adopt rules within the constraints of the statute you've been established to deal with that, and I think we've done that. An example, one of the issues that had popped up from last year was a one-to-one tie vote. First time in the commission's history we have adopted a rule that would prevent that from happening again. As I said in Representative Close's committee, you know, we may not be smart all the time, but we're not stupid. A lot of these issues, I mean, and frankly, let's be real about it. Part of the issue that came up, and it's what Betsy addressed to, is we had a very huge energy crisis that was unprecedented in the history of the Northwest in 2000-2001. There's nobody who wanted to see rates increase the way they did. But the reality is that through a number of events, that's what happened. The bottom line when you get to a commission decision is we have a balancing act. Our responsibility is to get just and reasonable rates. That's what the statute said. That's what the United States Supreme Court has said we have to do. Responding to that, and just and reasonable replies to allowing the utilities to have a reasonable return and getting, frankly, I'll put it in frank terms, the cheapest rates we can for the customers. Sometimes the cheapest rates we can get don't appear that way. But I think you would all agree that with any business, if they're out buying their raw materials at a 50% increase in price, we can't set a rate that's lower than their cost of doing business. We can jawbone that cost of doing business down. We certainly can and have tried to in the past constrain some of the expenditures that the utilities have made, and I'm not speaking just to PGE but others, but there comes a time that, you know, getting directly to Julie's question, if the cost of buying natural gas, which is the primary driver for new energy, spikes up, as it has, quite frankly. I mean, you look at last year, natural gas was $1.50 to $2 a unit. Right now, the trading price on natural gas is over $6 a unit. If the utility has to pay that, they're going to have to be able to cover that cost, and we're going to be dealing with that. Can we mitigate? Yeah, we have an ability to mitigate in law, but you need to understand what mitigate means. under the private property section of the United States Constitution, people have a right to a reasonable protection of their property rights, which is this is one. That means we could mitigate by deferring how we allow a rate increase to come into effect. But it doesn't mean we could turn it down completely. And we can constrain what those costs are, and we do, and that's always debatable, but we can't deny it completely, we can defer it. That's what we tried to do in the PGE case, and as it came to the end result at that time, just the difference, I'll be very frank, utilities could come nowhere close to borrowing money with what a lot of other industry could, just because of the nature of the business, and the rate of borrowing in the mitigation procedure we tried to do was more expensive than many people wanted at that time, so it didn't work. But we have the ability to do that. The other piece is that you should understand that the commission's operation are different than a legislative operation. We operate much more like a court. Under the statutes that this body has adopted, when we make a decision, we can only make a decision based on the evidence that is introduced into the record. In the last case, the PGE case, while we could have adopted mitigating factors, nobody raised that issue clearly in hearings. And I say that just from having gone back through the record. You should understand that I did not participate in that case before I was on the commission, but I have reviewed it. So there's some issues. Now, having said all of that, I think that everybody who practices in the utility business has learned a lot about that. There were a lot of mistakes. Certainly, in my opinion, the notification to customers of the potential rate increase was not adequate. I'm frankly surprised that the industries didn't do a better job communicating with their customers. Is the practice that I'm used to in businesses that you know, let your customers know what's going on. And I don't think we did collectively as good a job as we could have done. And I think that we would probably, everybody would do a much better job now than they have in the past. For the simple reason is no one wants to go through 2000-2001 again. An example of that. I spoke a minute ago about the natural gas prices. July 1st, knowing what's happening now, we have scheduled a meeting and gotten everybody that we could who's knowledgeable in this industry in the state to come and meet with us, and are publicizing it so that people who use natural gas, particularly industry, have the opportunity to understand what's happening in that marketplace. There's a lot of activities, but our goal is we may not be able to control what's happening at the pipehead, but we certainly want people to understand that and know that if they use it in their business so that they can plan ahead and to the extent they can adjust their prices can reflect that. We will, and my commitment to you is that I understand that the role of the Public Utility Commission, the only reason it exists is as a consumer protection organization. We represent the consumers and we're going to do the best we can to let them go. To the bill specifically, we've dealt with a lot of this before in a prior bill, 3575. The commission has taken no position on this bill and doesn't. I guess we don't have a strong objection to it. I'm not sure that there's a need for the bill. The mitigation section that's in here is our current statutory language is, from a layman's perspective, frankly, is somewhat vague. And calls for interpretation. This language is equally vague and calls for interpretation. I think the difference between the two is the existing language has been defined by judicial decisions over the past and has some precedent. This is new and maybe just as good, but I think it leaves itself open to additional judicial action. People will want to challenge it, as those of you who are attorneys know, that's the way you define the law, is you take it to court. And I'm not sure that the answer would be any different, but it's there. You know, if that's what you wanted to do, we would work with that. That's our role. You set the policy, we implement it. So, be happy to answer any questions you'd have.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Beyer, I see a Section 2 of the bill addresses the attendance of commissioners in hearings. Could you tell me what kind of attendance rules that the PUC has?
In the past, there hasn't been any, and you should understand that most of the way the commission does business is through a written record. as much. This kind of discussion first popped up to my knowledge in a previous interim task force regarding to, I think it was a 99 bill, 3615, House Bill 3615, and there was a discussion about how to do that. We made provisions, greater provisions for allowing parties in the case to ask for formal hearings and oral testimony, and we adopted rules to say we can do that. We've made that available. Be quite honest, since we've done that, most of the parties have chose not to participate in that, but we have, since I've been on the commission, we participated in a number of major issue hearings. Now, I want to differentiate that. A lot of the work that we do, such as some of the smaller telephone cases and such, are held by administrative law judges. That's what we hire them to do, to hear it and build the record for us, and we review that. So the commitment that we have is when there's a large process going on that's controversial, we'll be there. But we don't, I'm trying to think, I don't believe we have adopted a formal rule other than the one that deal with that. If partners feel that they need that, I think we can do that. But this one addresses at least one commissioner. I would argue with you, if it's important enough for one to be there, they should all be there.
If I have a hearing coming up, or if I have a situation with the Public Utility Commission, and it's all on paper, so the response from the commission will be likely back to me in the form of a report or a ruling of some kind, and no participation face-to-face. Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, it depends on the issue that you're talking about. If it's if you're talking about a telephone case or a complaint, citizens complaining against a telephone company, probably there would not be a commissioner who handles that. We have that delegated to our administrative law judges to do that. They do that fairly frequently. On rate cases that are larger, you're talking about a different process. I mean, you're talking of more of a judicial process where the decisions, the way we make decisions is we issue written orders. And in those orders, you would see, I wish I'd brought a copy in there, we address what the issue is, what each party has addressed the issues, how they've addressed it. So each item, if you were to say, I'm concerned about this, your concern would be expressed in the order, along with everybody else's, and then the commission's reaction to that, our finding on that, mm-hmm. that gets you down to a final conclusion that is the order of the commission. So if you were to read one of our orders, the whole process, I would argue that people would have a hard time saying that if they read the order, they wouldn't understand where the commission is coming from, because it addresses each specific item that someone has brought up in testimony, responds to it in a commission's finding, and then issues the final order or determination.
All right. Final follow-up, please. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So there must be an appeal process if I don't like the ruling.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gregory, indeed there is, and the appeal process is directly to the courts. There's been some discussion in this chamber about which court that should go to, but right now it goes to the circuit courts. And in fact, one of the court's review, which is somewhat different than other processes, is the court reviews the record, which is one of the primary reasons why we build a record the way it is. It's on appeal. They appeal on the record, and that's what the courts make their decision on. If a court's making a decision, their basic question that they are asked to ask is, did the commission follow its process in arriving at their decision? Is it logical? And is there adequate evidence in the record, our decision, to justify the decision we made? And if their usual action is, if they choose to disagree with us, they remand it back to us to deal with instructions.
If you'll just let me ask one more. In that appeal process, is there a place for economic impact of the decision by the PUC? In other words, is there some accountability of the economic impact of the decision that you've just made?
Mr. Chair, Representative, can you clarify what you mean by economic impact?
That would be just the economic impact of the decision. In other words, if it's a rate case, how are those rates going to impact the economy of that?
Okay, I understand your question now. Mr. Chair, Representative Rivera, the answer to that is no. Specifically, that is not provided for in the statutory language that we can consider that. And you have to understand that the choice is, some states allow that in some ways, but the choice is then you're making a choice of who pays the bill. Because we start from the premises that whatever the commission decides, we sort of have a two-step process, if you will. The first step is, what is the appropriate revenue amount you're talking about? You can call it the revenue requirement. We decide that. Then the second step in that process is, how is that revenue requirement equally distributed in terms of use among the rate classes? In states that take that into consideration, they have a provision that allows them to shift that cost, if you will, mm-hmm. off of industry onto other ratepayers. Mm-hmm. Oregon, like most states, has chosen not to do that. Mm-hmm. It's the idea is that each customer group will pay its equitable share.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions? Representative Moss Anderson.
Following up a little bit on the hearings process, first of all, who determines who's an expert witness? It states in here that you have testimony by expert witnesses and then cross-examine. First of all, who determines that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the parties who pay for the witness decide that they think they're an expert witness. We have no restrictions on who can provide testimony. I guess the answer to that one is the commission, when it sets down and decides the issue, determines how expert that expert testimony is.
Okay. Follow up. So you have the hearing, you have the testimony, and then a rate is established. So how is that information then communicated? How would, say, AOI, the businesses, get that information?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, how they would get that information is the same as everyone. It would be distributed in an order much like, in fact, they look pretty exactly like a court decision. Once we make a decision, we publish it. It's out there, and everybody has access to it. If you were to go to our web page right now, you could look at every order we've issued and read the complete order.
So when that decision is made, that's open. It's public. Do all entities know when you're going to be establishing a rate change?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, I think anybody who's following the process, and I say that understanding that probably most people don't follow the process, probably how they're going to get their information most on it is the coverage from the media. Certainly, we put out press advisories and something's happening. We don't discuss a case in advance because, you wouldn't expect the court to come down with a ruling. We haven't made a ruling, and we don't talk to anybody outside of the hearing room until we decide the case. Then we issue it, and I think most of you have probably seen at the time we issue an order, we issue a press release that summarizes it, and you all get it by email the day it's released. So you've probably seen them the same way. Those who have participated in the case are on, we have what's called a distribution list. Anybody who files as a formal party to a case constantly gets information. For example, if AOI is a party to a Northwest Natural Gas case, anytime anybody who's filed as a party to that case submits any information, they at the same time have to file it with every other party to the case. So everybody is informed of the process. Now, I'm being somewhat cautious here because I think the piece that's hard for folks to follow is if you're formally involved in the process, and I believe this is what Julie was getting into, it's a fairly judicial process and it takes a lot to follow it. If you're involved in the process, there really is no excuse for not knowing what's going on. I mean, it's a very open process. But if you're, you know, the common shop owner out on the street, you probably don't know what's happening in the case. And that's I'm not sure how to get around that, but I think that's a reality in it.
Mr. Chair, if I might follow up on that comment, because I think it's an important point that not everybody knows what is going on with a rate case. And even those of us who are very perhaps close to what was going on with the rate case that produced the 50% rate increases, we still didn't know to the very end let me tell you what we did know. Prior to summer, we knew that the rate case was going to be very large. We knew it was going to range anywhere from 30% to 60%. I sent out a memo to our members about that time just to let them know that it's going to be big. Still, it was what they would call, or what many would argue, no, they're there. 30% to 60%, that's an incredibly wide range for an energy user to deal with, especially if you're a manufacturer. In July, there was a series of questioning that went on where Commissioner Smith was asking what the rates were going to look like, what they were going to look like. And again, there was no exact number that could be produced. They were going to be large. But because the energy contracts were not coming up until the end of August and September, they could not say what the energy rates were going to be. And so this is where, you know, you see so much expression from our energy user members, that it wasn't until September that we got to know more exactly what those rates were going to be. And then depending on if your tariff changed or not, we had the finger pointed at us at AOI, well, why didn't you communicate to your members that this was going to happen? And our response was, well, what could we say? And so there is a, I think the commissioner noted, there is a notification problem that I think all the parties are willing to work on to make sure it doesn't happen again. I think one of the people that works at the commission, Lou Sparling, had a great idea that if you file a rate case at one level, and it changes significantly, because a rate case can take up to a year again, it's like a large court case. And in that year, if that rate case changes significantly, the amount that they're saying it's going to be, then again, there might have to be some additional notification to customer groups, broad-based, not just to AOI, not just to the Restaurant Association, not just to the Metals Council, because again, we only cover a portion of the business community.
Further questions? Okay. Well, Commissioner, wish you luck on your new commission. And I would think that with you being a commission of one now, you're probably not going to have too much difficulty breaking ties. But I know you're going to be in for quite a year.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hopefully that won't happen. We'll do it quicker. And if anybody has some suggestions on how we can make the process better, we'd certainly love to hear it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming in. All right, Sean Miller, John DiLorenzo, and Gary Bauer. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm here on behalf of my client, Portland General Electric, in opposition to House Bill 3640. I have some very brief comments, after which time I would like to defer to Mr. Miller and Mr. Bauer to give their particular client's view on the bill and also the issue. I believe that House Bill 3640 is a perfect example of how not to address admittedly valid concerns regarding the energy price environment. The original proposal was in House Bill 3575, received a very thorough airing before Representative Close's committee. That proposal, the amendments to 3575, which were submitted, and then LC 3614, which ultimately became this bill, were all unilateral exercises. Unlike the intervener funding bill, which the House considered and adopted, there was virtually no collaboration prior to the legislative session concerning the matters in this particular bill among the various interests affected. I would like to use a very brief amount of time to give but two examples of the consequences, and I am sure they are unintended consequences, that are attendant when the unilateral proposal vehicle is utilized as opposed to engaging in collaboration. If I could call your attention in the bill to line 16 of the first page, section 3, sub 2 of the bill, line 17, proposes that if the rates proposed in a schedule are changed after the schedule is filed with the commission, the rules shall require that customers have at least 30 days notice of the change before the rates are implemented. Well, this section directs then that no change may take place except upon 30 days notice. This, in my view, will backfire on customers. It will eliminate flexibility to immediately reduce rates following a suspension period. For instance, last winter, there was a power cost adjustment which increased some rates, but customers also received a $5 million discount due to a prior PUC oversight. The commission had to act quickly as customers were burning through energy in the dead of winter. This bill would have required a 30-day delay of the $5 million discount during the dead of winter. In addition, another unintended consequence, I am sure, appears in Section 5, in Section 5, Sub 2, and it talks about rate mitigation. And it provides that if the commission defers implementation of a rate increase under this section, the utility requesting the rate increase is entitled to receive a return on all deferred amounts equal to the percentage amount established by the commission as constituting a fair rate of return to equity holders in the utility or the prime rate, whichever is lower. Now, you've probably heard some discussion concerning the Hope decision. That's one of a number of U.S. Supreme Court cases that establish the constitutional standards for avoiding a taking in the area of utility regulation. Some of the language in this bill, a fair rate of return to equity holders in the utility, is a shortcut for establishing what that constitutional floor has to be. Assuming that that is the constitutional floor, a fair rate of return to equity holders in the utility. Anything less than that is less than a constitutional rate of return. To the extent that the prime rate would be lower than that rate of return, this bill would be void constitutionally on its face. In addition, there is no such thing as a prime rate. Every bank has its own prime rate. A prime rate is a rate of return which any particular bank furnishes to its very best commercial customers at any particular time. The bill mixes up concepts of return on equity to concepts of interest, which are very different concepts. If a utility's cost of capital is 8 or 9%, the most recent prime rate is around 3.5 to 4. And so this bill itself would constitute an unconstitutional rate, an unconstitutional exercise. Now, just like Senate Bill 205, the intervener funding bill, that bill was the result of collaborative process. It was not one based on LC drafts furnished with very little time to response, which necessarily places the entire utility community in a reactive mode. Now, this is not to deny or to deride any of the valid concerns that customers have over electricity costs. We share their frustration. PGE does not generate all of its power. It must purchase significant power on the open market to satisfy its customer obligations. The utility is equally frustrated with the instability of the power markets. So we stand, on behalf of PGE anyway, ready to have a thorough discussion of these issues and of the various ways to resolve them in the appropriate forum, but prior to a legislative session, when we can have a thorough opportunity to vet all of the concerns and the modes of resolution to ensure that there are no unintended consequences, which will necessarily result when we engage in this unilateral proposal and reactive process. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman, and I'm available to answer questions or defer to my colleagues.
Okay, thank you. And gentlemen, just as I think as we heard from AOI, since this isn't looking like it's going to be moving forward, you know, I appreciate your need to make sure that this horse stays dead. But you know, there's a fine line between beating a dead horse and trying to revive it through resuscitation. So you know, hopefully you'll stay on the right side and keep us kind of a limited time frame here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent Pacific Core, a electric utility that operates in Oregon as Pacific Power. I appreciate your comment, Ms. Chai. I want to share the and do appreciate the issues that the customers have brought forward. We are committed to working with them following this legislative session. I know we have given our commitment to take these issues and work them in the proper forum, which is at the PUC, and then and I'll leave it at that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Bauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Host of the Committee, Gary Bauer, representing Northwest National, and also appreciate the opportunity to comment. If I might just make a couple of side comments, Commissioner Bauer did comment about the gas prices right now and the fact that natural gas is increasing. I guess I would like to share with you just quickly a little bit about our rate process. We currently have what's called a general rate case in front of the Commission. And the general rate case looks at all of the costs for the company's operations, and that includes pipes, trucks, our pipeline safety program, staff, customer service, et cetera. That's about half of our rate. The other half of our rate is the commodity natural gas, and that is adjusted annually, and we file with the commission, and we'll file later this summer, and then the commission reviews those, reviews the contracts that we have, and those go into effect. There is a difference in those two types of rate cases. The general rate case, you file, you give your customers notice, and the way the process works, your rates would go into effect within 30 days unless the commission suspends it. They always, in my knowledge, in 25 years of doing this, have suspended your general rate case, and you then trigger another six-month process for hearings, which can then be extended. So you can go up to 9 months, and that's kind of back to one of the responding to Ms. Anderson's question about do people know what the timeline is and when a decision will be made. Yes, there is definitely a decision-making process in there. And then for the commodity side, which we file, it too has a known process in which we file. Again, we let people know what's happening. The media follows rate cases fairly closely. Generally, the media will let you know the minute we file any kind of a rate case, whether it goes up or down, quite honestly, and then they will also generally check in throughout the rate case if things are changing. They'll let customers know again, and then at the end of the process, we do our own level of notification. We notify people up front. You want people to participate in that process starting at the beginning, not after the decision has been made. And that's one of our concerns about a notification process. For us, we want people to be at the table and participate and work with us on those rates as we go through the process, not come in after the fact and then be concerned. So those are kind of the two different processes we have going and will have going this year. I could say a lot more, but I won't, other than just say that we, too, are committed to working with the commission and customers and trying to resolve the issues. There are a number of issues that we've talked with them about over the years. The interesting part is we've maybe been on opposite sides. A few years ago, we thought it was a good idea to have commissioners present at hearings, and some of the customer groups didn't. So, again, as a result of that, we think we all ought to just sit down and figure out how to make all this process work. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Very good. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. No one further listed to testify on this bill, so we will close the public hearing on 3640 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3154, and we'll ask Patrick Brennan, the administrator, to come up to the dais. And let's see who we have. Okay, let's call for Don Eubank and Mayor Jerry Abood. Do you have some written testimony, Chief? Yeah.
Committee members. My name is Don Eubank. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Staten. I'm also the Interim Director of the 911 Center in Staten. And I thank you for allowing us to come today to talk to you about this most important issue, House Bill 3154. A couple of points I'd like to make. My presentation will be very brief, and we'll be happy to answer any questions. There's two documents that were put together in 2000 before the legislative session by the Oregon State Police, or commissioned by the Oregon State Police and Oregon Emergency Management. It was first a statewide study on 911 services provided, and the second study was a study on multi-PSAP counties, multi-PSAPs in various counties. And the bottom line with both of these studies was simple: if it works, don't try to fix it. The reports were forwarded to the Oregon Emergency Management and then passed on to the legislative session. There are a couple or three things I'd like to read you out of this study, which brings my point home, I hope. The Office of Emergency Management encourages the legislature in its current session to continue funding for statewide 911 capabilities at present levels. The consultants conclude that the optimum number of PSAPs in a county depends on local circumstances and that no single approach fits all cases. And lastly, the state should regard consolidation of communication centers as an issue for local determination and should not mandate consolidation of primary PSAPs. And Mr. Chair, members, this really concludes my testimony. Again, I would emphasize that we support this bill, and we're hoping to let the control or the destiny of dispatch centers or 911 PSAPs to the local jurisdictions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mayor Abood.
Thank you, Chairman Doyle, members of the committee. My name is Jerry Abood. I reside at 836 East Cathy in Staten, Oregon. I'm the mayor of the city of Staten. We support this bill before you for several reasons. We do not think forced consolidation is good for communities. We believe it adds, in essence, one more level of answering that takes more time to respond to emergencies. Currently, cities can consolidate at any time if they feel it is in their best interest. By you supporting this bill, you allow us to continue doing what we do best at a local level. In summary, we support the bill. We do not feel we should be forced into consolidation, and 911 tax money should continue to flow to the existing 911 centers. And thank you very much for your time.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Bircher.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a question, but I do want to recognize both Chief Eubank and the mayor. And we had a great meeting in Staten, and I want the committee to know about that. They opened the theater to a number of people who would want to testify about these bills, that those of us who were interested in this issue. And it was actually a great evening. Lots of good testimony, and so I'm sure that you'd both agree that you didn't come to just this conclusion on your own. Even if you had, you certainly had a lot of support that evening, and thank you so much for being so gracious and hospitable and giving us an opportunity to hear from people throughout Oregon, all over the state.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
And Chief, how many people were at that meeting?
Approximately 150.
And all from all over the state, different public services.
Medford, the coast, Eastern Oregon, and some of those folks are here today.
Okay. Great. All right. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, too.
Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jeff Cruz, State Representative, District 7. This bill has had an interesting track through the system, and I appreciate this committee's willingness to hear the bill. I understand there are amendments to the bill. I'm in support of the amendments, which is basically the deletion of the last section of the bill. And let me describe what that section was designed to do, because this bill was filed very, very early in the session. It was designed to be theoretically an accountability piece, but when we look at the 911 legislation that is probably going to be coming out of the Ways and Means Committee, I think those issues are going to be addressed there. And so we decided that it was better to have a bill come out of this committee that was clean and distinct and just remove the consolidation language from statute. And so the bill before you now looks actually identical to about three other bills that were filed this session to deal with this issue. I think what the subcommittee has been working on over time may have some value, but I think that will be driven, if indeed consolidation happens over time, it should be driven by other factors other than the state deciding consolidation should happen. We know historically that things work best from the ground up rather than the top down. And so I think that by number one, I need to, and Representative Barnhart, I'm sure, is very well aware of this. There are four call centers in Lane County, which I now represent a big chunk of Lane County. The four call centers worked very well together for a long, long period of time until they were forced into doing this planning for consolidation, and then things didn't work so well anymore because we set up turf battles. And what we have discovered over time is the fact that to consolidate Lane County into one call center would leave portions of the county uncovered. Pure and simple. And that is unacceptable. I represent two of the call centers, one's in Oak Ridge, one's in Cottage Grove. Both of those have single trunk lines to Eugene, as does Florence. So a trunk line's cut, and suddenly you have no 911 system for those communities. You know, so there's some real logistical things that need to happen over time for the concept of consolidation to become a reality. And I think we need to allow the technology and the needs of the local communities to determine how that happens, rather than the state forcing the loss of what are real community assets at this point in time, and those to the local call centers. So all this bill does is remove that language from statute, and it puts us back to where we were 2 years ago with a system that was working very well, where we weren't having people who need to cooperate with each other feeling threatened by each other. So I appreciate you hearing this bill. I urge passage of this bill. This is one issue that is totally bipartisan and has very broad support both in the House and in the Senate, and I think will move very quickly. I'd be willing to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions?
This is really a question. I was just going to comment that I think the representative has described the situation in Lane County altogether too well. And, of course, the other two call centers, one of them are in Representative Berger's district, and the other is in Representative Farr's district. So they're widely scattered. And in a county like Lane, with such a widely diverse geography is the word I'm looking for. It doesn't make sense to consolidate in a county center.
Yeah, and just in closing, you know, I wasn't really aware of this issue until redistricting. And suddenly, when I was starting campaigning during the primary season in Cottage Grove and in Oak Ridge, and they said, you know, what did you guys do to us? And I said, I have no idea. because this thing kind of slipped under the radar 2 years ago, but trust me, I have been incredibly well educated on the subject of call centers, and this bill and this action is absolutely appropriate at this point in time.
Representative, you were at that meeting in Staten as well, and,
yes.
And I think, and you touched on the issues just of how a public safety community basically turned on itself with this.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain that a little bit more? I mean, just the examples of or you know, what you drew from that meeting and elsewhere about how the dynamic changed with these, I guess, with this move to consolidate?
Well, Chair Doyle, basically the way the dynamic changed is, the Cottage Grove and the Oak Ridge call centers were, number one, these folks that work there are part of the community and they understand the community and they're kind of an integral part of that. And clearly, if there was going to be a consolidation in Lane County to one call center, what was going to happen was all the others would disappear. Well, to say that means that they would kind of disappear because they'd still have to have some functions there, but suddenly these communities would have to be paying for them all themselves with no assistance from the state out of the 911 fund. And, so they were very threatened by that, and justifiably so, because we're dealing with communities, Oak Ridge and Cottage Grove, who, I mean, the state's in recession. These guys are in a deep recession because they were timber-dependent communities. And, 6 months ago, Oak Ridge just lost its last mill. You know, so they're striving really hard for some sort of economic vitality in the community, and to have the basics of public safety not present there makes it even harder, especially when you look at for example, in Lane County, how thin the sheriff's patrol is spread and the amount of time it takes to get a call in, the logistics of just going for a call going clear down to Eugene and then somebody in Eugene trying to figure out where this road is that this call's coming from is really hard. And then you get into the Cottage Grove area. Well, Cottage Grove also, that call center also serves northern Douglas County, so there would be a complete disconnect at that point in time because central Douglas County is not handling those emergency calls now, and so suddenly there would be a whole section of Douglas County who would be unserved. So, it was just a matter of, something that was a core asset in a community being threatened to be closed, and it just created bad feelings among everybody there. Even the call centers who are going to end up having it all didn't really want it. And, it just created adversarial relationships where none had existed before.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions?
Thank you very much.
Representative Barnard?
I thought of a metaphor for this. Suppose you said that only lawyers who lived in the county seat could file lawsuits. Lawyers who lived outside the county seats weren't allowed to anymore.
Interesting.
Well, if we could eliminate lawyers filing lawsuits, that would be a good thing, but I don't think that's good. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Roger Bennett and Ray Jones. And Michelle Deister. Sorry.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Michelle Deister with the League of Oregon Cities. You already heard from officials from the city of Staten, and we also have representatives, the manager from the city of Florence, Roger Bennett, and the assistant manager, Ray Jones, from the city of Hermiston. I'll be very brief. Basically, the League of Oregon Cities supports House Bill 3154 and the Dash 1 amendments. As Representative Cruz stated, these Dash 1 amendments basically make this bill identical to others that were submitted from legislators throughout the state, and they all basically say the same thing. Please maintain funding for our current 911 centers and system and ensure the safety of Oregonians. This session, we've heard some discussion about consolidation and interoperability of public safety systems, but until the legislature adopts interoperability as a policy, and until questions about how that system will work and be funded are answered, we feel it's important that the legislature consider House Bill 3154. So with that, I would like to turn it over to Mr. Jones and Mr. Bennett. Thank you.
Thank you. Helen?
Thank you, Chairman Doyle, and members of the committee. I brought with me today a letter from our mayor, and I would like to read that into the record. It says, as addressed to Representative Dan Doyle, Hermiston, with its 14,000 residents, is in the immediate response zone in the event of an emergency at the Umatilla Chemical Weapons Depot. The Army and the State of Oregon are responsible for the plans and systems needed to safely dispose of the chemical weapons stockpile on-site by incineration, a process which, once initiated, will take several years to complete. The City of Hermiston's primary PSAP has the direct responsibility for and knowledgeability of all first responders in the event of an actual emergency at the depot. The city's PSAP Communications Center is also tied to vital emergency incident information communications with the depot. Any prospective delay, loss, or diminishment of the city's public safety communications center capabilities caused by service from another distant PSAP would be a direct endangerment of our citizens pursuant to the disposal process and civilian public safety protection systems. Signed, Bob Severson, Mayor of the City of Hermiston. I would just add the comment that the Hermiston Safety Center PSAP is very critical in an emergency situation at the Chemical Weapons Depot. It provides the necessary capabilities in an actual emergency with the proximity of that depot. Response time and information flow is essential for the protection of our community, and any time delays due to the transfer of information is unacceptable. I guess I would just close by saying not only is consolidation at this time in our point of history for the City of Hermiston a bad idea, it very well could be a dangerous idea for our citizens.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Bennett?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Roger Bennett. I serve as City Manager of Florence and also as the administrator of one of those notorious Wayne County PSAPs. The Chair and Representative Berger and Representative Chris, I'm a veteran of the state meeting and very appreciative of the folks in state and what they did there. Most of the points that I would raise today have already been before you. Representative Cruz handled the Lane County portion of it rather well. There are significant technical difficulties in delivering countywide communications in a county as large and as diverse, geographically diverse as well as politically diverse as Lane County. And I can only underscore that with a few figures. First of all, we did some economics. This would not save money in Lane County. In fact, it would raise operating costs dramatically. First year costs are estimated to go up by $500,000. Ongoing maintenance costs are estimated to increase by nearly $200,000 a year at today's dollars. It's not a cost-saving bill. Points have been made that PSAPs have been consolidating regularly for the last 20-odd years, and local governments continue to do that. In fact, when we started this quest to talk about House Bill 3977, there were 53 primary public safety entry points in Oregon. Now there are 52 because two of the Jackson County PSAPs consolidated at that time. I would just offer the very obvious point for the record is that the best way for emergency response to get out to the emergency is through the least complicated communication system. That responder needs to get to that emergency through only one communicator, if possible. And to envision either a telephone handoff or a faulty radio system dispatch from a long distance can only offer the obvious dangers to the people involved in the emergency. With that, I would thank you for your attention and urge you to get this to the floor with the DUPEX.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Close.
Could I comment on the bill?
Certainly. Actually, why don't we go forward? We'll get into work session. Is that all right?
Okay.
Let's close the public hearing on 3154 and open up a work session on House Bill 3154. Representative Flores.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the Dash 1 amendments.
Representative Flores has moved adoption of Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3154. Discussion. Representative
yes.
Close.
I need a clarification.
Excuse me. Representative Close.
I will withhold. I'll wait for the general discussion.
Oh, okay. So, Representative Monsanto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I need clarification on, I know this one account, the incentive fund, is being abolished, and then the money that's in that fund is going to be then switched to the emergency communications account. And I was just trying to figure what then will that money, can that money be used for? What is the basis of this account? I couldn't find it in the books, but basically what it says is, you know, the monies can be used for anything in the emergency communications account. Do you know what those funds?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moss Anderson, I'm not certain as to the specifics of the second account. We may have somebody in the audience who might be able to answer that question.
Okay. Cindy Robert.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert. I represent the city of Medford, so I've been following this very closely. There is no money, Representative Moniz Anderson. It was taken out during one of the special sessions and used for other purposes, so there actually is no money in the fund. So don't worry.
That's what I was
Okay. All right. Further discussion on the Dash 1 amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
Maybe this is the best time for me to make a comment. I was one of the five, I believe, legislators that brought different bills. The Dash 1 amendment actually accomplishes what several of us had hoped to accomplish, and so I'm just very pleased today. Thank you very much.
Okay. Any objection to the Dash 1 amendment? If not, adopt the Dash 1 amendment. And Senator Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3154 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Flores has moved House Bill 3154 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and that subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded. Discussion. Colleagues, just on that rescission of the Ways and Means referral, is that the prior bill, just without the amendment, had a fiscal to it. This one does not. All it does is just repeal the mandate, so there is then no fiscal impact at all on the state general fund. Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to concur briefly with much of what's been said. I serve on the Palestine Rural Fire Board, and we are a rural fire board out north of Albany, and we have a lot of grass seed fields. And we had an occurrence where there was a fire some time ago, and the call went to Corvallis, and it had to be transferred back to the Albany station, which they're the ones that came to the call. So there was this time lapse, and my question to the fire chief in Albany was, could the property owner have called the Albany Fire Department directly? And he said no. They still would be referred to 911. So, big problem the way I see it. So I support this bill.
Thank you. Further discussion. The as a participant of that meeting in Staten, where there were, I guess, about 150 or so members of the public safety community in attendance from around the state, I thought, probably the best evidence of bringing an issue to the attention of the legislature that, a decision was made 2 years ago to try a consolidation effort with all the best intentions. Truly, I know many of us voted for that, thinking that it was actually helping people and helping not only the state with some revenue issues, but also helping the communities with which it was being served. And the message came back loud and clear that this was not the right option. And I think that at least my hope is that one of the messages that's going to be coming from the legislature back to the public safety community is that we hear you, and although it's taken a few months to get to this point, I don't think that there was any intention to do otherwise. It was just a matter of the timing, and we've been able to at least get this accomplished, and from what I can tell, it should not have any difficulty to get out of the House and out of the Senate as well. So, there's a lot of issues we've had to deal with in session. There's a lot of issues I know that many folks in public safety have been concerned about, not the least being various funding issues, but at least in this particular case, we think that this is a very good at least symbol, if nothing else, of recognizing as a legislature that we, regardless of our better intentions in the past, that we know that from what you have told us that this makes a lot more sense, and we've heard that, and we're trying to correct that. So with that, let's call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Roll time.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
And chair votes aye. And given the number of people that have had this kind of bill presented for consideration, I think as chair, I'll just go ahead and carry it, and giving due acknowledgement to all those who made this an issue earlier. But sure. So you do that. So that the House Bill 3154 is moved to the House with a due pass as amended recommendation, and I go to the Speaker to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. That closes our work session on House Bill 3154. And now open up a work session on proposed change in the rules of the House of Representatives. It's a work session. We're opening up a work session on the proposed amendment to House Rule 2.05. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the amendment to House Rule 2.05 as presented in the proposed amendment dated 6/17/03.
Representative Flores moves the amendment to House Rule 2.05 as presented in the proposed amendment dated June 17, 2003. Any discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure what motivates this amendment because I haven't been privy to any of the conversations that led up to it. But as I review the rule, procedures for amendment, the current rule simply allows time for adequate notice for the members of a body to have an overnight to look at the proposal. This amendment, as I understand it, and I'm ready to be corrected if I've misunderstood it, essentially allows for a vote to be taken immediately on an amendment, essentially without any notice in advance. And I can't think of any reason at all why the House would need to amend its rules without any notice, or without at least one day notice. It's hard to imagine a situation of that sort. And in a situation where action needs to be taken immediately, rules can be suspended by a two-thirds vote. So presumably if the House is concerned that it needs to act immediately in an emergency, it can do that by general agreement, by two-thirds vote. This simply, I have to say, makes no sense to me. It seems to violate one of the general principles of parliamentary procedure, that members of the body be given adequate notice of the things that they're about that they're going to be asked to vote upon. And for that reason, I would oppose the amendment. I'd certainly love to hear what the justification or reasons are for such a departure from the normal rules.
Further discussion. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chairman, I would concur with Representative Barnhart. I'm such a process person, and traditionally this is the process. It isn't an extended, it's for one day prior to a vote, which, as busy as some of us are, that doesn't give us a great deal of time. So unless there would be some overriding suggestion that this is necessary, I would I don't quite understand it.
Mr. Chair. Representative Close.
Mr. Chair, I do support the amendment, and I would call to the attention of the committee the action by some, and this has not just happened in this legislature, but it's also happened in Texas, members who walk out and deny a quorum because of the legislation that's going to come before them. And I think that it is appropriate that we try to deal with that increasing problem, and this amendment would do that.
Further discussion? And I would only chime in to look to some decisions that are going to be made in the next few weeks, in particular as our budget discussions are progressing. At least I'm being optimistic in saying that they are progressing, but we do have some key votes that will be coming up right around the first part of the month, in fact right at the end of this month, in the form of continuing resolutions for the budget, and part of the issues revolve around the fact that this is going to be the first time that we have continuing resolutions, at least in the recent past, that continuing resolutions are going to not automatically carry over programs and functions that were part of the last budget, just as a function of our budget situation and our financial situation. So with that, need was expressed that we may be making some split decisions towards the end as we get to the end of the month. The good news is, as the rule states, that any kind of rule change that comes before the chamber must first come through this committee. And regardless of those who are concerned about the timing of getting a rule through the process, it's not going to come to the floor without any notice. I mean, there will be notice to the entire body, just because it comes to us first, and that part has not changed. That the only thing that's changed is that we will be removing the requirement that it has to lay on the table for a day. You notice, those of you that attended the session this morning, is that there was a second amendment that was highlighted as a proposed change, mm-hmm. and that was to remove the referral of budget measures to Ways and Means. And as you can see, we're not dealing with that today because it's not an issue today. And yet, that may be something that also has to be dealt with, at least in the near future. It's something that the Speaker's looking for a little bit more flexibility on managing the budget situation with and the budget negotiations. So with that, we're looking to see what we can do to keep moving these budget negotiations forward, and we're looking at this as one part of that process. So with that, Representative Los Anderson.
I'm still a little puzzled, and we are, and maybe you can help me with this. We already have a process where we can suspend the rules, and it needs 2/3. That's 36 votes. That is a true bipartisan way of dealing with the things that would come before the committee. And we could do it immediately if we suspend the rules. And you still haven't quite explained to me why, since we already have the process to deal with something immediately, why we would need to change it this way. And maybe you'll just have to repeat to me what you said in a different way.
Right, and just to note, The procedure for suspending rules, which is in Rule 2.10, it's actually it is two-thirds, 40 votes.
40 votes.
So,
okay.
And you know that particular rule, although there is a requirement that that kind of rule would not apply with the Rules Committee, because I mean it still comes to us first, and then it's just when it gets before that's the decision to whether it lays on the table for a day. Or whether it goes immediately to the vote, that would require 40 votes, and you know, in essence, that's what this rule is doing is it's removing that issue so that it can be done without. Basically, it's just by a majority vote.
Mm-hmm.
So, with that, let's.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask you to clarify something? So, if it comes here first. What you're saying is there actually is a one-day notice before it comes to the floor?
No. This the current requirement is that any rule change comes to the Rules Committee
right.
to vote out, as it would any other bill that goes to the floor. Then it sits at the table, at everybody's table, for a day. Okay. What this is doing now is saying it still comes to the Rules Committee. It gets debated, it gets decided upon from the Rules Committee, then it goes to the floor and it could be up for immediate vote instead of waiting a day. Okay? All right. Let's call the roll.
Representative Backlund.
Aye.
Representative Reinhardt.
No.
Representative Close.
Aye.
Representative Forrest.
Aye.
Representative Leonard Anderson.
No.
Representative Virgin.
No.
Chair Doyle.
Chair votes aye. And the... House Rule Amendment, House Rule 2.05, is adopted as amended, and will move to the floor. Let's see. The amendment has been adopted now. Representative Forrest.
Mr. Chair, I move House Rule 2.05 to the floor with it be adopted as amended recommendation.
Representative Forrest has moved House Rule 2.05 to the floor with a be adopted as amended recommendation. Discussion.
Well, it's the same, isn't it?
Yeah, what we did, it was my apologies, we acted on the amendment like any other amendment. This is now moving it to the floor. So, let's call the roll.
Representative
Backlund.
Aye.
Representative
Barnhart.
No.
Representative Close.
Votes
aye. Representative
Forrest.
Aye. Representative
Leonard
Anderson.
No.
Representative Virgin.
No.
And Chair Doyle.
And Chair votes aye. And House Rule 2.05 is moved to the floor with it be adopted as an amended recommendation. And Carrier on this is the chair. And that closes the work session on proposed amendments to House Rule. And nothing further.
No bills today?
No meeting Wednesday.
No meeting tomorrow.
Tomorrow. Right.
And
so we'll be looking for
today?
Thursday.
No bills today. No introduction bills today.
That's correct.
Okay.
All right. Nothing further. We are adjourned.